This podcast has been generously sponsored by Jill and Mark Baker, Yonina and Andy Gorno, Daniela and Michael Rader, Paul and Rachel Jacoby Rosenfield, and Rabbis Jenny and Rabbi Eric Solomon. For details about sponsoring future podcasts, please email jamie@pardes.org. This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, and welcome to This Pardes Life. This is David Levenkris speaking. Today I have Judy Klitzner with me. We're going to be speaking to Judy Klitzner in the next few weeks about what she feels passionate about and the text behind that. And the series is called From the Personal to the Political. Judy has been teaching Bible and biblical exegesis at Pardes for nearly two decades. She is a disciple of the great Torah teacher Nechama Leibovitz, and Judy is known for weaving together traditional interpretation, modern scholarship, and her own original interpretations that are informed by close readings of the biblical text. Judy lectures internationally and is the author of Subversive Sequels in the Bible, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other, which received the 2009 National Jewish Book Award for Scholarship. Judy is also involved in Jewish and Orthodox feminist causes and is a founding member of the Shira Chadasha Partnership Minyan. Judy, like many of the teachers we've interviewed, is also a friend of mine, and it's just a lot of fun to have you together with us today, and I'm really, really looking forward to this interview. I've been in your house, and you have this beautiful house, and I've been to Minyanim in your house, in which men and women have both participated, and I almost think of you as part of the fabric of South Jerusalem, which, of course, to me, is the epicenter of the world. But you often mention that you grew up in a small town in the United States, attended a small day school and an even smaller Jewish high school. I just have visions of these two or three little girls in a class. And I'm interested, especially when we think of you today as being, I think of you, at least and many others do, as being very much a central mover and shaker in the world of Judaism, of Orthodoxy, and of liberal trends within Orthodoxy. How did growing up in this small place, how did this affect you, your identity as a young Jewish woman?
Thank you, David. It's a great pleasure to be here and always good to talk to you. I suppose it's hard for me to draw straight lines from one place in my life to another. So we might have to go on a bit of a circuitous journey when I tell my story. But I would say it does start in this tiny little town in a tiny little Jewish day school. There were two children, but there were nine. From there, I went to a very Orthodox girls' high school from the Beit Yaakov movement, which had four. I had four girls in my class. I would say that what characterized those experiences, first of all, everything being that small and that intimate, was a very positive thing in my life. There was a feeling of great warmth to the Judaism that I experienced. There was a feeling of kind of a simple emunah, belief in the things that we were learning. I was excited about it. It was just a great feeling of belonging. But together with that, there was already from a very early age certain kinds of dissonances that I would say, if I'm starting to draw some of those lines, those dissonances started very, very early. And it was only when I got to this wonderful, great, cosmopolitan, yet bubble-like neighborhood of Southern Jerusalem that I was able to play out some of those dissonances, work them out in constructive ways. So it all begins in this very, very tiny town in northeastern Pennsylvania. And although the education was warm and encompassing, it was also not the greatest quality.
Can you think of one incident specifically that really expresses for you these different dissonances that you felt?
Well, yes. I would say it began with a feeling of, lots of discussion about Jewish ritual objects, right? You say Kriyat Shema every day, and the boys whip out those tzitzit and kiss them. And the girls are saying the same words, Uri Ten Otan, right? You see them and you think about all the mitzvot that you're learning about. And it's a kind of connection between the ritual object connects the person to the religion. What became clear to me from a very early age was, yes, that's true about Jews, but not female Jews. So that was, I would say, dissonance number one. Together with that, there was, I think, maybe even a bigger dissonance, the notion that not only do you not need to do that, but you shouldn't do it, even if you want to. And here, my own personal experience, I grew up in a household that was a very female household. My father, unfortunately, was disabled, and my mother pretty much raised her three daughters. And so all the rituals that had to be done in the home were done by four women. And we were quite capable of doing them. We did them with all the best intentions. The things that I was learning at school, I wanted to enact at home. That was the most natural thing in the world to do. But yet the messages that I was getting in my school was there's something suspect if you do those things that you don't have to do. I would learn, to give you an example, I would learn the laws of building a sukkah. And in fact, we built a sukkah, my mother and my sisters and I, and that sukkah was built to the greatest extent of every halachic specification. Yet when I came to school and we had a sukkah, and there wasn't enough room for everybody to sit under the kosher part of the sukkah, they said to the girls, why don't you sit under that tree over there, honey? So there was this strange, this dissonance between what I was learning and what I was experiencing. I knew on a very deep level that as a Jew, whether female or not, I was capable of doing these things, and it was better. It made me more connected, not less connected, to be doing them. When it came time to have a bat mitzvah, when I turned 12 years old, we made a joke about it. Aha, this is a time when you would have a bas mitzvah, but of course you're too religious for that. That's for those other kinds of Jews. So there was this odd conclusion where somehow doing less, being less ritually connected, somehow made you more religious. And I knew there was something wrong with that.
I was actually just thinking recently of what you said. When we do surveys about how many people attend shul in Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, in fact, in the ultra-Orthodox community, it's unfair counting, because in those communities, and maybe in certain modern Orthodox communities, it's actually piety not to go to shul, ironically. And it's actually not, you know, it's using everybody with the same scale. And there really is this irony that the less you do. I met a woman the other day who, for example, will make Havdalah, but won't do it with spices. And she's actually doing less than other women, but in a certain milieu, she would be regarded as very, very observant for not doing that. It's like a less is more. And the more strictures that I put on myself, the more I have. I'm interested if there's an incident perhaps later on in your life where you felt the exact opposite, perhaps a moment of radical inclusiveness, or a moment where you really did feel that you're part of this. You've spoken about how you felt separate. But I'm interested if there's one. I know it's sometimes hard to find one moment, but if there was a moment maybe later on in your life where you really felt radically included.
That would have to be the first time I had an aliyah in shul, in Shira Chadasha, where I stood with one hand holding on to the Sefer Torah, looking into the Sefer Torah as it was being read, and feeling just an overwhelming sense of connection and completion of, not completion, that's too strong, but a very far distance traveled in my efforts to become a full Jew. If I could, though, I wanted to say a couple other things about some of those earlier thoughts. One of the explanations that I was given that hit me always as somewhat disingenuous and apologetic was the notion that I wasn't obligated to do these things because I was better. Because I was, women, young girls were on a higher spiritual level than boys, so you don't need those rituals. You can do better, you can do without them. If somebody on the other side of the mechitza is saying Vizota Torah and they're pointing at a Sefer Torah, and I don't actually have visual access to that, that's because I don't need to see the Sefer Torah. I'm fine without it. I knew on a very deep level that that wasn't true. Maybe there was something wrong with me that I did feel that I needed those things, but I knew that I was being fed something about separate but equal, that wasn't really so true, not, at least not for me. I just want to say also there was another side of this, which was, yes, I'm superior, And here comes the high school part of this, some of the early messages. In high school, one of the main messages, this is when a kind of obsessive discussion of tzniut, of modesty, started taking hold. And together with that came the basic equation that, okay, here it starts with this, men slash boys are animals. Okay, men are animals. And as a result, you, young woman, have to cover yourself, right? Because you don't want to lead astray that animal that's just dying to come out. This, on two levels, was very upsetting to me. First of all, you know, I was friends with boys and they looked like human beings, so I wanted to think they actually were. And it was a little frightening to me to think that there was some kind of, you know, tiger lying beneath that exterior, that surface. And the second part of it that bothered me was a feeling that, well, if they really, let's say they really are animals, when I go to the zoo, it's the animal, it's the wild animals that they lock up, not the innocent observers of the animals. So why was it my problem if they couldn't control themselves? So all of these things were kind of, you know, cooking around in my head, wondering why is this making sense? Together with that, there were messages about certain statements, rabbinic statements about women. Women are, and there were usually lists of characteristics. Women are lazy, they're chatterboxes, they have a tendency toward being licentious, all these things that were written by men, but these men were they were presented as having an infallible status. If they're saying these things about me, I am supposed to believe that those things are eternally true. That was also very, very disturbing.
Thank you for sharing that. It's very, very hard stuff to hear and to feel. I'm interested in how the insights you had about the unfairness, the untruth, the lack of truth of this affected you when you were bringing up your own children.
Yeah. I think the turning point for me, and this is fast forwarding many years, but as you say, there was this sense from many women that, you know, the firmer you are, the less likely you are to go to shul. I was moving closer and closer to being just that firm. It got to a point where it was so hard for me to sit in shul. I felt so excluded, so disrespected just from the physical space of the shul and the, you know, just the disconnection from everything that was happening, that I simply did what so many other women my age were doing, which was staying away. I think the turning point for me was when I noticed that my daughter, I have four sons and one daughter, and when I noticed that my daughter was not interested in going to shul, I said to myself, enough, it has to stop here. There's got to be something that I can do that will at least give her a fighting chance, that will make her want to connect to this thing. There was one Yom Kippur, I think it was the Yom Kippur that did it. We were looking around for shul. We started in one shul and we were both very upset with what was going on there. I said, come on, let's get out of here. And we started roaming around southern Jerusalem looking for a shul where we could feel connected to what was going on. And it was very hot outside, as it tends to be on Yom Kippur. And we went from one shul to another, to another, to another. And at the end of that day, I said, it's time to start thinking in new ways.
It's interesting what you're saying, Judy. And I've actually read a few sociological studies that say that the reason that Orthodox women don't go to shul has got a lot less to do with frumkeit or what's expected of them, and simply that women hate shul so much. So why not come for the haftarah, stay for the sermon, be there for musaf, go out and make the kiddush, and that you can get two birds with one stone in a way. You can be regarded as very pious and not go to a place that really excludes you. I can even speak anecdotally when occasionally I've run learner services and I've said, can somebody come and help me? The number of women who've wanted to help me run a learner service so they could get out of having to go to shul in a pious way has been very, very great.
Well, I used to think about it as being invited to watch a show, but I know in advance that I'm going to get obstructed seats, right? I mean, how much motivation would I have to go run to that show? The idea that I was hoping for was that shul could become an experience that wasn't just a spectator experience. At the very least, what I was hoping for, that if it is a spectator experience, at least let me spectate without obstruction. But even better than that would be somehow to be actively involved in the experience.
And of course, that's what happens today at Shirach HaRashan and the partnership Minyanim you have been involved with. I was in Australia a few years ago, and I said, I'm actually not a founding member of Shirach HaRashan. I said, there's no hall in Jerusalem big enough to contain the number of people who claim to be founding members of Shirach HaRashan. But you really were Do you want to tell us a little bit about that process and how it came about?
We've got some of the foundations of it already. The feelings that I had of being excluded, the emergency that I started feeling when my daughter was feeling excluded as well. It also came with a certain, I would say, philosophical change that came over me. And I just want to preface this by saying that this is many years in the making. When I was growing up, I did not learn Gemara at all. And the reason that was given to me that we were not to learn Gemara, we young women, is that it was simply forbidden for a woman to learn Gemara. And we were given the sources in the Talmud that explain why women don't learn Gemara. And that was the end of the conversation. What I discovered later, especially the year that I came to study in Israel after high school, was that all of a sudden we were learning Gemara in this very advanced women's learning program. And what happened was we took that same source, and if I might actually take the liberty of reading it to you, that same source was used to say, yes, it's true that you weren't supposed to do this, but now we have a new understanding of this source. And the source is very well known from the Talmud in Sota, the 20th page of Sota. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Kol Hamelamed Bito Torah Ki Ilu Melamda Tiflut. Rabbi Eliezer said, whoever teaches his daughter Torah, it is as if he teaches her licentiousness. And that was an open and shut case. You don't want to teach your daughter licentiousness, so don't teach her Talmud. When I got to this very respected Institute of Higher Learning for Women called Michlala in Jerusalem, I learned from my teacher, Rabbi Cooperman, that yes, it's true that women in general should not be studying, women wholesale should not be studying Gemara because that would be problematic. But because of a changing reality, we have a new way of understanding this comment in the Talmud where it's anybody who teaches his daughter Torah is as if he's teaching her licentiousness. But if there's a woman who initiates, she has the capability and she comes asking to learn, that's a whole new situation. And in that situation, it's okay. And when I heard this, it was mind-changing. Like the idea that we could take a source that was used as an absolute negation of something and turn it on its head and say, our reality has changed, so our understanding of this source has to change, was what opened all kinds of doors to me. And then I became aware of course, the famous case of Sarah Schnierer in the early 20th century. This comment in the Gemara was initially talking about Torah Shebichtav, learning Torah, the written Torah. And this young woman came forward and said, the sociological conditions have changed. I understand why it was considered a problem for women to study this earlier. They weren't capable of it. Women weren't so intellectually capable. But now the opposite is happening. We are actually losing women, and their connection to their Judaism by keeping them away from their own text. And famously, the Chafetz Chaim in the early 20th century came forward and said, yes, we're actually, by keeping this prohibition in place, we're getting the opposite of what we want. That, again, is game-changing. It's taking the rules and saying, let's look at the rationale behind the rules. And as a result, the rule itself changes.
Without psychoanalyzing you, Judy, I'm wondering whether your interest in subversive sequels comes from seeing a text that could be read in one way and then looking at it in a different light, seeing we'll have a chance to have a look at that. But I'm just struck that, seeing something and without changing the words, without changing even the context of it, but understanding that our context is different, those same words can be seen in a very different way.
So those of you out there listening to this can't see me nodding my head very, very strenuously. Yes, yes, and yes. I think that my understanding of reading Tanakh is very closely connected with my understanding of halakha, something as a very, very dynamic process, something where the rules change all the time and they're supposed to.
Thank you for that. Maybe give us a little bit of a taste of what it was like of the founding days of Shira Chadasha.
So I was having these thoughts for a long time, that if it's true that women's learning, something that was considered prohibited, could become not just permissible, but encouraged, because the idea is for women to become better and more connected Jews, the germ of the thought was in my head, that the same must be true of ritual, and it must be true of women's halachic knowledge and leadership as well, that in every realm, we have to take our sources and look carefully at them and see if there's room in those sources to empower and enable women rather than to disempower and disenable women. So that's what I was thinking. I was also studying a great deal of reading a lot of literature by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. It was very influential in my thinking, looking at the whole system of halacha as something dynamic. Halacha is not a noun. It's not static. It's a verb. It's something that you're always moving with and moving toward. You're trying to create a more moral world through the use, the correct application and constantly changing nature of halacha in order to create a better world. With all that as background, I was starting to form this notion in my head that I knew enough to know that within that in ritual, there was certainly room for women to do a lot more in ritual spaces than they were currently doing. And that the only reason they weren't doing that is because they had never done it. And people thought it would be improper, pasnished, as we would say. And so I started looking into it. I started looking into the halachic reasoning. I started talking to lots and lots of people. One of the people that I talked to early on was my dear colleague Rachel Berkowitz, who very fortuitously happens also to be the granddaughter of my hero and what I consider to be my Rav, Eliezer Berkowitz. There was one meal that really stands out where she was at my Shabbos table and with her husband, and I don't remember if they had children yet, but she was crying at my Shabbos table because she was so upset about this. Yeah, okay, so Rachel cries, but she cried. She was very, very upset about this. And we started to talk and we started to plan and we decided, okay, it's time to work. And we sat down and we composed an email and very carefully selected who should receive this email. There was a very serious cloak and dagger feeling to the whole thing. Very, very dangerous. What if it gets into the wrong hands? Of course, we were totally naive about email. Of course, anybody in the world just pushes a forward button and there it is. And there actually were some consequences early on. People, well-meaning friends came up to me and said, you know, there are those people out there this one's not speaking to you. And I said, oh, well, I guess it's not so bad. I didn't even notice. But there were people who were very angry and thought that this was undermining their you know, the foundation of their Jewish belief, the halakha. Belief, slippery slope, who are you, all these arguments. But I think what I've come to believe is that an idea whose time has come is usually thought of by more than one person. And so the fact that Rachel and I were thinking about it, we had a meeting in our home. We got together some great thinkers in our living room. I remember among them were Professor Tamar Ross, my brother-in-law, Mendel Shapiro, who later wrote the famous 70-page halachic treatise on the question of women getting aliyot in an Orthodox setting. And we sat around and discussed these things and kind of, you know, worked them out and started to formulate a real plan. Yeah.
There are those to the left of Shirach HaRashah who will claim that it still really hasn't embraced the challenge of modernity in the sense that it's not completely egalitarian. What would your response be to a critique like that?
Yeah, I hear you. I share that frustration. I dream of a day where there will be full egalitarianism. I'm not there yet. I understand that there have been people who have worked out halachic arguments in favor of full egalitarianism. I just say personally, I'm not there, and I understand why people will feel frustrated with this. There was a decision made by the people who founded Shirach HaRashah and who have been running it that we want to do things at a certain pace. We want to make sure we're very well grounded and that we don't move too quickly and more than the public is aware is in favor of moving. And I'm always very cognizant of Rabbi Yitz Greenberg's famous 15% rule. If you're not 15% ahead of the people that you're leading, you're not really doing anything. But if you're more than 15% ahead of them, you're going to lose them. And so I think we have to find that balance of where to be close enough to the people to lead, but not to leap ahead too quickly.
I'm interested in how all the different things that you've spoken about today, how they influence you as a Torah teacher and particularly as a Torah teacher at Pardes.
I think I want to turn the question around. Maybe it's how being a Torah teacher at Pardes has helped influence me in doing some of the things that I've done. Being a teacher at Pardes keeps me on my toes. There are no obvious pat answers to serious questions. And that has, I wouldn't say forced me, it has enabled me to constantly rethink every single one of my positions. And it keeps me honest, it keeps me fresh. And I think that's been a very big influence in the way that things have progressed in my life.
Thank you, Judy. And we look forward to many, many years of your honesty, of your freshness, and you teaching difficult and beautiful Torah to us and to everybody else.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, ELMAD.pardes.org.